Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
We're Team Shoup, and we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond sound bites and highlight reels.
Hello, I'm Matt Bush, the news director at Blue Ridge Public Radio. I also help the Shoups produce Going Deep, and in this episode, we continue our conversation on the rights of college athletes. We left off discussing how the lack of unionization or even advocates for collegiate athletes oftentimes leaves them at a disadvantage, something the Shoups say they witnessed firsthand during the time John coached at the University of North Carolina and Purdue University.
You were talking about how the wage really now for students is the scholarship they get. Well, at North Carolina, the big scandal there is the academic scandal and the programs athletes were being put into. Those programs, do they offer students, the people who go through them, any sort of academic advantage once they graduate with a degree like that?
Well, that is a very interesting question, and one that I believe John and I have been completely changed about. I think when we left the NFL and went to college football, we chose University of North Carolina because we respected it academically. And we really wanted to be in a setting where we felt like the players were, you know, their lives would be better because they had that degree and that it would be a real degree. And while we were there, we truly felt that that's what they were getting. While we were there, the academic piece of the scandal was just this tiny little, you know, crack in the system that maybe some tutors were doing some stuff they shouldn't have done. Maybe they were doing some things on papers that they shouldn't have done. But there was no whiff of the fake classes or anything in this first phase of the scandal. But what we did start to wake up to was that even without the fake classes, which to me just completely delegitimizes the whole thing, you know, And a lot of those players didn't even know the classes were fake. They just thought they were doing a directed reading and a professor was grading it. But even without those classes, we had players who were very good students and who wanted to take certain classes, like an upper-level economics class. And they were told by different officials in the UNC athletic department, from assistant athletic directors to academic advisors to, I'm sure, some coaches, although this coach sitting next to me wasn't one of them, that you can't take that class because we don't have tutors for that class. And sort of the behind that is you couldn't possibly do that class without a tutor. And then we'd have players who were like, well, I'm coming because I want to major in, like Michael McAdoo, I want to major in criminal justice. And coaches were like, great, North Carolina doesn't have a criminal justice, you know. So then he gets to the campus and there is no such thing. And so what's he going to major in? What was that one that they kind of channeled everybody into about leadership or something like that? I can't remember the name of it. But so a place like North Carolina, we thought it was a great academic opportunity, it was actually a lesser academic opportunity than a place like Purdue because they have such limited majors. They only had, 75 majors or something like that. At Purdue, there were over 200 majors. And so a player comes, and he's going to get channeled into the major that is going to make getting to practice easy, is going to fit with the tutoring staff that they have. And so all of those things really diminish what that a degree actually gives that person. Number one, they may not study anything they give a whiff about. But number two, They may not even have the opportunity to do meaningful work, even though they want to, because of the way the system is set up. And I want to say out loud, and I know this is not a popular thing to say, that's not just football. It's basketball as well. Mm-hmm. That, you know, at a really kind of state university that sees itself as sort of an Ivy League of the public university system, players are at a disadvantage. That degree isn't going to be as good as maybe a Purdue degree, where how many different majors were represented on Purdue's team?
There were over 30 different majors.
So you see right there, kids are able to choose mm-hmm. what they want to do. And so therefore, you've at least started with the possibility of having a more meaningful degree.
What were some things that happened at North Carolina that sort of woke you up to these sorts of things? I mean, some of the examples sure. you were talking about, you know, how players were directed away from certain majors and into other ones. But what were sort of the things that sort of woke you up to what was going on there? Because this obviously still has not been, the school still has not received its punishment or its sentence on what this is. And that's a good five
well,
or six years.
Well, some of us did.
Oh, that's
some
true.
Of us received our punishment.
Yeah.
Several players
yeah.
did.
I agree. You're right.
I understand very clearly some did. 18 players were suspended, mm-hmm. and a ton of coaches, administrators, everyone were fired.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, some did.
But the school itself has not, the programs
right.
itself have not faced anything.
Right. So I can pinpoint the exact time when my heart dropped and I thought, what's going on here? This is a true story. I was in the room, and I don't care what anybody else says. I was there. We recruited a young man from the Tidewater area in Virginia. I won't say his high school. I won't use his name or anything, but the Tidewater area in Virginia. He was a wonderful student in high school, And when he got to North Carolina, this was about year two or three there, when he got to North Carolina, he was struggling. He was struggling academically. And so in the spring, Coach Davis, Butch Davis, was our head coach at the University of North Carolina. He and I were back at this guy's high school recruiting another player. And in the state of Virginia, to go to Virginia Tech or to go to the University of Virginia, at that time, you didn't have to take a foreign language. But if you were to come to the University of North Carolina or a North Carolina State School, you had to take at least 2 years of a foreign language to get accepted. And so we were talking to a young player there who was actually a sophomore at the time. And we said, if you have an interest in the University of North Carolina, this was a teammate of a player who's already at our campus. If you have an interest in the University of North Carolina, your junior and senior year, you're going to have to take, a foreign language. So we started talking about foreign languages and stuff like that. Well, the young man's in the room with his head football coach. And so as we're talking, Coach Davis, our head coach, says to the coach, you know, maybe you can help us as well. The young man that we recruited from here is struggling a little bit. You might know what buttons to push. You might know ways. He was really, you know, earnestly trying to figure out how to help this player and be what he needs us to be. And I'll never forget, you know, the coach paused and he looked at us and he said, well, here's the first thing, Coach Davis. He took Spanish for 4 years at our high school. Why do you have him in Swahili? And Coach Davis just sat there staring at him. And then he looked at me. And then he looked back at the guy and he's like, that's a really good question. He said, this guy's a straight-A student for 4 years in Spanish, and now you won't let him take Spanish. He's having to take Swahili. And Coach Davis was getting mad. I thought he was going to start yelling at me. I'm like, But it's the first time that I realized, you know, coaches don't pick the player's schedule. They don't pick their classes. And so when we got back to campus, he called an academic meeting immediately. He called an academic meeting. And Cynthia Reynolds was the head of our academic department at that time for football. And he said, I got to tell you, I was completely embarrassed. Someone needs to tell me why our players are in Swahili. We've got this guy that's got straight A's in Spanish, and we're not letting him take Spanish? And she sat there, and I was in the room. She sat there and looked at him, and she said, you don't know what's going on, do you? He said, well, I know that we've got players that are in Swahili that have gotten A's in Spanish throughout high school. Now, if our players were getting A's in Swahili, maybe I'd be okay. But they're getting C's and D's in Swahili. Tell me what's going on. She said, you don't know. My heart dropped because I didn't know. Yeah. And soon after that, Cynthia resigned her position and went to Cornell University. And not long after that, the entire football staff got fired.
That was a really important moment. And I want to add, that's something we told the Weinstein report lawyers, and it was not put in the report. Because what they needed was for Butch Davis to look like the bad guy.
Okay.
Like he was doing that.
So this was things as university, but you're saying the university was putting the kids into the classes and the football coaches, you had no idea.
The coaches had nothing to do with it.
We got our player schedules, and I monitored every player's grades.
If they were going to class.
And if they were going to class. But I didn't choose their schedules. And
African American studies was something that was – a recruiting tool. I mean, that you can come and learn about your culture. And at the same time, my sister was getting her PhD in African American studies and taking classes
in Chapel Hill.
She was in some of the classes with these guys. Mm-hmm.
So the Swahili classes were a part of these programs that now are being investigated as being shams.
But
the classes were real.
Okay.
The grading and stuff like that, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. And again, the players didn't even necessarily know that was going on.
Uh-huh. They didn't know when a secretary was grading their paper. They didn't know. They turned in work.
Right. But really, the time that was one of the biggest openings for us was Devin Ramsey. And we have a whole conversation with him in our earlier podcast series. But Devin was a player that John recruited, excellent student from a strong family, great player with NFL potential. He was a fullback and just a great person. And he was one of the players that got suspended. And there was a gag order. No one could talk about what was going on. And so when Devin got suspended, we were all like, Devin? You know, he's not that kind of kid. What could this be? But we just sort of accepted, well, he must have done something wrong. So Devin was out for almost the rest of the season, and he was at our house for Thanksgiving. And I just thought to myself, it was right when all the Jerry Sandusky stuff was going on. And I just thought to myself, screw it. I'm asking him. Nobody can tell me not to ask stuff. I'm not employed by the university. So at our table, and Gio Bernard was sitting right there with him as well. They were, you know, in the same meeting room and stuff. And I said, Devin, what is going on? What did they accuse you of? And he went on to explain it to me. And it just sounded like the most absurd thing. It was a paper he had written 2 years ago. He didn't even have it anymore. And it was about a sentence being moved from the front to the back. And did he do it because a tutor told him? I mean, it was just ridiculous. And the university had told him if he pled guilty, he would get back to playing sooner. And he did. And then the NCAA banned him for life because of academic fraud. When he's saying, I don't even remember that paper. I didn't do it. We are sitting there listening to this ridiculous story, and Gio Bernard, his teammate, somebody that he saw every single day, was like, You didn't do anything? I thought you must have done something. And that's when we realized the players were just so alone. They weren't talking. They were just trying to be good soldiers so they could get back on the field. And Devin was never going to get back on the field, even though he had been a good soldier. And so I wrote a blog post about that. I got in touch with Joe Nocera, the New York Times, and that kind of opened up this whole territory. And you know, long story short, Devin got a lawyer, Bob Orr, former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice, and he got reinstated. And first game, blew out his knee, you know. So Devin was an opening for us too.
Yes.
That during the scandal, we started to realize we were trusting that the university was on the side of right and the players and making sure everybody was treated fairly. And that was when we realized, no, they're not. No, they're not.
Is this because they, again, view this as an industry that's bringing them in a lot of money? Or is it a lot of an image thing that they don't want? Again, this is North Carolina school that considers itself a public Ivy. Is it a lot of an image thing that they don't want to say this happened?
I think at North Carolina, the image piece was big. The Carolina way. And that we just don't do things like that here. And I think that the other thing that was shocking and just frankly just so disheartening was how quickly people turned against these young men.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly they became thugs and, you know, they never should have been here anyway. And they should have just been thankful to be here. And they need to learn how to act. And, I mean, we heard this from athletic officials at the university, even from non-athletic officials toward the very top, we heard this language.
Well, I think one thing for our listeners to think about, there were 18 players that were suspended. Every single one of them was a person of color. Players that I have talked to, that I coached, that I love, that Marsha loves, that our children love, one player said to me, "Coach, they told me if I got a lawyer, I would appear more guilty, so I didn't get a lawyer."
But you had one player who did get a lawyer and was reinstated.
Finally, right.
Yeah. Right. So what would you do if—
But he had been told that, too, before he got one.
But, I ask our listeners, what would you do if your son or daughter had the one thing, or had one of the things that they've trained their entire life for, and someone tells them, if you get a lawyer, you're going to appear more guilty? That's not good business. What if someone told your son or daughter, just admit guilt? Your son said, but I didn't do anything. Just admit guilt. The person who was told not to get a lawyer was banned for life by the NCAA. Yeah. The person who was told to just admit guilt was banned for life by the university and the NCAA. That's when it, you know, kind of stirred me when these guys came to me and said, "Coach, I did what they told me to do."
And also, what a skewed version was presented in media sources. That, I mean, we knew what was going on, and then we'd read in the paper, and it'd be like, that's not what's going on.
I would encourage anybody that's interested in this to go back and look at our first series. And we have a number of episodes on sports justice, but in particular, the episode on Devin Ramsey, I think it's jarring, and I think it'll really make you think about issues of justice and due process in a lot of different ways. Marsha talked about Joe Nocera, who has been an outspoken critic of the NCAA and all this stuff. And Joe and I got into a discussion one time. Joe's a former New York Times writer and now writes for Bloomberg News. Highly respected individual. But Joe said, you know, as far as issues go, I mean, this is not that important. This is just the world of sports. And I took exception to that because I think our podcast, I think our discussions, I think our life in sports has to do with race, has to do with long-term health, has to do with social justice,
gender.
Has to do with gender, has to do with religion, has to do with all of these things are in every topic and everything that's in the world. And
they're billion-dollar industries, so if there's a billion-dollar industry in anything, you're going to see societal issues somehow come through in those sorts of things when there's that much money around.
Right, and even when sports aren't kind of bundled with profit, they are offspring of our of American culture, particularly football. And so they're mirrors, you know. We need to let them speak to us. And I think that's part of what we want the show to be, is a way for people to look at – sometimes we can look at sports more than we – maybe we can look at, like, ourselves or or our justice system or something like that. Is it a way – is it a kind of doable way for people to see how race is functioning in sports? And then they look – then they turn and look at the rest of society and think, yeah, now I can see more clearly how those dynamics are at work. That – I think that's our hope.
When Marcia and I speak at churches or at different functions about sports or whatever – one of the things that we talk about, we use the acronym WIN, WIN, WIN. And a win for us in one of these podcasts, in any discussions that we do throughout the country, a win for us is if people wonder, investigate, and notice the topic that we're discussing in just a new way. It makes you think. And I know I personally have had a lot of wins as we've researched different topics going through here. I'm like, well, I've never thought of it that way before. And I can't tell you how many people have, you know, listened to things that we've discussed and said, well, I guess I just never saw it through that lens before. And I think we really try to be intentional about getting that win when we discuss a topic.
To go back on something we were discussing earlier about image of universities, and talked about how your belief of North Carolina, a lot of this was protecting their image. We certainly know that was the case with the Sandusky scandal at Penn State. The cover-ups there were to protect the image of the university and its football program. So from best you can tell, why is image such an important thing, not just to the universities, but it really is to the fans of these schools and to your alma mater? Why is the image and sort of how you view that so important to them that a lot of some of these scandals, even maybe Baylor, you can say too, where it comes to it's protecting the image of something because it's so important to the people who went there?
Well, I'm going to have to answer that as a theologian. I'm going to have to roll out the term idolatry. Now, people hear the term idolatry and they think like a golden calf or, you know, some kind of, you know, deity made out of something. Idolatry really is just filling something that is finite with infinite qualities. And we see the same dynamic with things like nationalism. But universities are really carriers of institutional idolatry, where we pour into them this, you know, kind of nostalgia around how they've formed us and what they stand for, and you know, that we can trust them and that they embody the best parts of who we are as a culture. And I think universities particularly have really done that well. You know, we have these lofty values about knowledge and freedom and conscience and all these things, and kind of equipping people to be global citizens. And so those things are what get students in the door. Those things are what make alumni give. So there's a real kind of food chain there, where the steady diet is the university is worth my money, my life, my identity. I'm going to put it on my body. I'm going to use my Sundays and Saturdays for it, because that is how part of how I understand myself as an impact player in this world. I am a part of something that is making the world better. So when something happens to tell us that these institutions are not what we thought they were, that's really tough to see, and it hurts. It hurts, and a lot of people can't see it because it's not just a loss of like, oh, shoot, you know, I kind of like them. It's like mm-hmm. it's kind of your whole world crashing in. Mm-hmm. And we've witnessed that at North Carolina. It's got some real loyal alumni that love that place with every ounce of their being. And so it made sense to them to do whatever they had to do to protect the brand, even if some people got run over mm-hmm. in the process.
So if they're saying something about North Carolina is wrong or something mm-hmm. about Penn State is wrong, they're saying something about me is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's why we fight back?
Not only something about me is wrong, but the universe doesn't work the way I thought it would. There is no carrier of good and right things that I can trust anymore. If you've filled that thing with an infinite, transcendent quality, you really do have sort of a revisionist way of understanding. I mean, religion functions the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, we give God a lot of of rope on some things when there's some pretty horrible things in the Bible that God mm-hmm. seemed to do. But yes, it's sort of that loss of identity and loss of just kind of something to hold on to.
I think it's interesting when you use the word idolatry. One of the shows that we did in this series is on the University of Michigan in the Fab Five. In the early 90s, the Fab Five were five freshman basketball players at the University of Michigan that took the game of basketball and collegiate sports really to another level. I mean, millions upon millions of dollars, and people rode their coattails like coattails have never been ridden before, the Fab right. Five. And then after 2 years, Chris Webber got investigated. Chris Webber was a star player on that Fab Five basketball team. Got investigated by the NCAA and got in trouble. And if you were to go to the University of Michigan right now, there's no banner, there's no picture, there's no recollection of the Fab Five. It's tried to whitewash that history of everything that they brought. And so I think when Marcia talks about that idolatry or the love for a university, it's much bigger than any coach, any player, mm-hmm. There's something else that really connects people to that university, so much so that they were willing to, frankly, disown Chris Webber, the mm-hmm. greatest Wolverine basketball player who, you know, to save the image of their university and
to also maintain their understanding of what collegiate sports really is. I think that's another thing that's hard for our university culture to look at, is that they have embedded in their midst a for-profit business mm-hmm. that exploits people. That's not really in line with the university's values. So it's, you know, how do you make sense of that dissonance? Well, you just talk about the few bad apples mm-hmm. and you get rid of them instead of looking at a system that really violates the core values of an institution. Mm-hmm. You only do that when your goal is protect, not, you know, how do we make our values actually more cohesive throughout the campus and make sure it actually functions in everybody's lives. We did not see that at work at Purdue or University of North Carolina, I would say, when it came down to equity issues especially.
And talking about, you mentioned it with the Fab Five, that they're not in the media guide. There's no banners. And mm-hmm. this seems to be a common NCAA punishment. North mm-hmm. Carolina could get that for some of the basketball national championships that they've won recently. Louisville could get that for the one it won a few years ago. Joe Paterno lost wins on his record for a while, though they were reinstated. USC lost a football championship. But we all watched those games and saw them win those games. So why is this a punishment, do you think, that the NCAA levels at these universities after the fact, years after these incidents have occurred?
Well, I think that's an important fact, and I think it's one of the things that we really discuss in our show about the Fab Five, where we talk with Ray Jackson and Jimmy King. One of the things that protects the scaffolding of the NCAA and the way that it works is by the time people realize that they're being manipulated, that their rights are being trampled, that, wait, this isn't as fair as I thought that it was, they're graduated and gone.
Or kicked out.
Or kicked out. Part of what perpetuates the system of the NCAA, of collegiate athletics working, is that it's always cycling. Nobody's there for 8 or 12 years. No players are there for 8 or 12 years. They're there for 3 to 5 years. And once they realize, nuts, this isn't exactly what I thought it was, they're on to something else.
Right.
And I think Jimmy and Ray really, really talked about that. It wasn't until they were kind of gone from Michigan that they realized, hold on a second. Mm-hmm. They can't do that.
And it's also one of the only thing the NCAA can do. I mean, they have no legal status. And this is kind of a gentleman's agreement.
Yeah, it's
that
like
this is a way to create public humiliation, shame. Don't be like these rebels, hooligans, thugs.
Doesn't seem to work, though, much, right? Doesn't seem to work, though, right?
I think it's humiliating for players. I think,
well,
you know,
for players, but not for the universities. It doesn't
not
seem to be.
No, I mean, and it's sort of absurd, you know, when you think about it. But to me, it's more about this kind of public humiliation of players. Like, you are dead to us. We don't even remember your name. We don't even remember what you did here. I know they did that to Hakeem Nicks at UNC. He was one of the best receivers ever to go through that school. Maybe the best. I don't know. But Hakeem had no opportunity to even speak to what the accusations were against him because he wasn't even at the university anymore when they did that. Mm-hmm. So it's something they can do. It's sort of a bullying tactic that, well, we're just going to erase you. And I know with Hakeem, the word that kept coming to me when that happened was just humiliation. And it when you look at it, it's absurd. But it functions to keep players in their place.
Yes.
If you mess up, we have all the power. We can even erase passes and games and statistics and your name. We can even erase that. And with some players, you aren't welcome back on this campus. You can't set foot on this campus. You can't be an alumni of this campus even though you graduated from here. Those are really humiliating things.
Chris Webber, to this day, doesn't go back to the University of Michigan, the players were telling us. That's sad.
Well, either to some of those UNC players.
Well, many of the UNC players aren't allowed to come back to the University of North Carolina.
And some of them who are allowed don't want to go back.
Mm-hmm. Last question to sort of put a bow on this one. Josh Rosen's the quarterback at UCLA right now, and before the season started, he's majoring in economics at UCLA school, academically one of the best in the country. Majoring in economics, and he said, because of the intensity of that particular degree, that football and school don't mix, because it's difficult for him to be a full-time athlete and be a full-time student in a very difficult degree program. What do you say to that? Is that true?
Yes, it is very difficult to do that. It is. Very difficult is not the same as impossible. As a coach, I have told players, listen, if you miss practice on Tuesday and Wednesday, it's going to be hard for you to be our starting quarterback on Saturday. Well, Coach, this is the only time that that class meets, is right during practice. Well, I understand. Then you have a decision that you have to make, you know. I've never told a person to take a class or not to take a class. But decisions do have consequences. If you're not at practice Tuesday, Wednesday, you can't, it's going to be hard to be the quarterback. Some players have missed practices before. You know, guys that might be backups or something like that. It's hard. There's no doubt. This is a solvable problem. Very easily solvable. Many universities, not all, but many, more than a handful, practice at 6 in the morning. Other than ROTC, I don't know of a class that meets at 6 a.m. So you could practice from 6 to 8 a.m., and then whatever class you want to take, you can take. So it's solvable. People just have to do it. There's an answer. The difficulties that smaller schools have, i.e. a Wake Forest, i.e. maybe in North Carolina, as compared to larger like Ohio State or Purdue, are they don't offer courses, the same amount of courses at all the different times. At Purdue, you could take courses all summer. You could take courses, you know, in the evenings.
You could do them online.
You could take courses. There was more breadth to the choices you could make at a bigger university. The smaller the university, you know, well, that course is only offered at this time, is only offered at this time. You do. You have to make decisions. But it's a solvable problem, and I've said it to every head coach that I've ever worked for and have never worked at a college university where we did practice in the morning, and I really thought we should have.
So that's one way of dealing with it, is kind of adapting the practice schedule to an academic schedule. Another way is to think more creatively about what the function of sports on a campus is. This is a job. When you have a music student that is very talented and maybe they are employed by the local symphony, they have sort of a conservatory model where during the symphony season, maybe you're not taking any classes. Maybe you're taking a few classes. But there's a sense in which your role in the symphony is educational, is benefiting the university, is a part of your experience. Why can't sports do that? Why can't the season be a time in which players maybe don't take classes, or maybe it's an internship and they embed in the season things like leadership training and, you know, personal economics or things like that, that actually would help the player function in the business of sports. We still have this mythology that, oh, well, it's just an extracurricular activity. Football and basketball, and frankly, all sports on big-time university campuses are not extracurricular activities. They're a full-time job, more than a full-time job. Why don't we honor that? Why don't we treat it that way and bundle it with some of the ways that we treat other people with skills in engineering or music or, you know, now even technology, people who have consulting businesses and stuff while they're in college because they're really good at tech stuff? Why aren't we more creative around the industry of sports? It's, again, it's an interesting phenomena to look at. But I think if we could just bust out of that model a little bit and be a little bit more creative, I agree with John. It's a solvable problem.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. And make sure you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.